Goddard rule 4. Okay.
Well, the use of hydrogen, of course, or coal gas as we used in these balloons, is the lifeblood of the proceedings. If you use up your coal gas or your hydrogen by valving it away to reduce your buoyancy, you automatically reduce the length of time you can stay in the air at all. So you have to conserve it by all means, and therefore you have to study this use of this study we did during ballooning was highly important in its application to airship flying. Another thing, of course, we did in ballooning was in preparing to land, you would lower your trail rope, and your trail rope would go down with a bang onto the ground, and that would give you an additional buoyancy straight away, because when the trail rope, or at least a good deal of the trail rope, was lying on the ground and trailing through the ground like a snake, the weight of it was being borne by the ground and not by the airship. So consequently, the airship was that much lighter, and in a sense, it acted as a sort of elastic to aid you to land without too much shock. But if you were coming down fast, you'd have to check it with ballast as well by letting go ballast. Now, the same applied to landing an airship. You came over the landing party, which was on the ground, waiting for you at a certain place in the landing area, and you would drop your trail rope. And that would trail through them, and they'd grab onto it and would perhaps pull you down or check you if the wind didn't check you already, if you weren't really hovering over them. And they would haul you down. And all the time, of course, as the weight of the trail rope was passing into their hands, you were getting more buoyant, and so that would counteract the fact that you were heavy to begin with.
Were there any particular hazards involved in balloon flying?
Well, any kind of flying, of course, once you begin to defy gravity, can be a menace to you, but usually the hazards produced very amusing results. For instance, I was talking just now about the trail rope, which you can use as elastic, really, to prevent your using ballast. But you must be careful how you do it. We once were drifting over the countryside of Kent through the orchard country at lunchtime, and really, to save ourselves the trouble of botheration, we had the trail rope down, and so we knew we wouldn't hit the ground, because if we came lower, there would be more trail rope on the ground, and so on. But suddenly our lunch was disturbed, and everything turned over sideways, and drinks were upset, because we didn't realize the time until somebody could peer over the side of the basket and see a farmer retreating into his cottage, and also see that he had smartly taken a turn around one of his cherry trees with the end of our trail rope, and that had caught us properly, and we'd come down, kiting down, but of course we rode up again vertically, and by the time he emerged from his cottage, what do you think he was carrying? He was carrying a shotgun. He thought, believe it or not, that he had captured a zeppelin. And one of our party had the presence of mind to call out, "Don't shoot, we are English." And this, of course, saved the situation. But he was very disappointed, because it had been something to tell his grandchildren. The other occasion was that I remember was a friend of ours on the same batch with me. He was doing his solo, which took him over Windsor Great Park. And he decided to land in Windsor Great Park, quite near the royal residence. And he dropped his trail rope, but he was trailing through the country too fast. And so he dropped his grapnel, hoping it would catch one of the trees. There aren't many hedges in Windsor Great Park. But what, in fact, it did catch was in the flank of what was probably a royal cow, that then immediately took charge in an agonized state and charged across the countryside in all directions, trying to get rid of this grapnel. So it didn't really stabilize the balloon at all. In the end, the poor cow had to be destroyed.
Were there any other memorable flights from Hurlingham?
Oh, well, every flight was memorable for people who took part, because the aim of the business, of course, was to give you sufficient experience to be put into a balloon by yourself. And so we did day flights and night flights, and then when you were thought to be competent to do yourself. You would get given a little solo balloon, and we went to Wormwood Scrubs for that, as a matter of fact, and flew away from there on a solo flight in a hydrogen-filled balloon, and any kind of adventure could happen to you then. I remember I didn't actually smash into the greenhouses of a tomato grower, but all but did. He thought I was going to. I just missed it by a very short fraction of a few yards. Another of my friends landed in the overhead wires of the tramways. Well, that was very disconcerting for him and for everybody who wanted to get through the street, because the whole business was held up for a long time.
I believe one of your practices was to find a suitably affluent-looking residence, which would be a convenient place to land
and
scrounge lunch.
Yes. Well, not lunch, tea. We'd had our lunch in the air, as a rule, but we used to do our navigation in such a way that we would accidentally come down, so to speak, at least only ostensibly by accident, in some splendid park where we were pretty sure that we should be provided with an excellent tea. And I must say, one day we did land at Tibbles, or Theobald's, as you would find it spelt. And there we disturbed a tennis party. We wrecked a conservatory. We landed finally in their duck pond behind a batch of trees and thoroughly disorganized a tennis party, but thoroughly enjoyed the strawberries and cream which were prepared for the tennis players. And we then motored back to London. This was in World War I, remember? And I didn't discover until just before we were leaving that that house was the property of the Admiral commanding at Portsmouth. And just before we departed, Lady Muse said what a shame it was that the Admiral wasn't there. And I thought what a very good thing it was that he wasn't there.
Now, after Hurlingham, you were posted to Kingsnorth, where you were first introduced to airships. What part of your training did you go through at this station?
Well, Kingsnorth gave us training in aerostatics, which was the art of ballooning that we'd already been practicing. It gave us the theory behind gases and the advantages of one sort of gas and another and the disadvantages, and the permeability of fabrics and all that sort of thing. And we learnt about structures, about the aeronautical structures as they were applied in airships. We learnt about the different types of airships, Astra-Torres type, the Parsifal type, Zeppelin type, and that sort of thing. But what we were doing was non-rigid airships, so we concentrated on the design of the kind of ships that we were going to fly. We learnt about instruments. We didn't have to learn about navigating because we were all trained navigators already. We'd been in the Navy for years. We learned a bit of meteorology, and then we did quite a bit of practical work on the ground of learning how to do wire splicing and how to use fabric dopes and how to use rubber adhesives and all this sort of thing. In fact, a general theoretical and practical training to equip us to understand how an airship was made and how it flew. And we also did a course in engines, that is to say, in aero engines, and their differences, if any, and the developments that were going on in regard to lighter and hopefully more reliable aero engines.
What was the scale of activities at Kingsnorth when you went there, as far as the airship activities were concerned?
Well, there were the hangar floors were covered with incipient airships, if you get what I mean. The rubber manufacturers were making airship envelopes as fast as they could. We were borrowing or deriving the fuselages of aircraft, B-2 aircraft, from government sources. We used those as the bodies of the airplane, the things in which we flew, and the things that carried the engine. The body of the airship, really. I mean, the car of the airship, as we used to call it. It was simply an aeroplane fuselage without any wings on it. There were also the planes, that is to say, the stabilizing or directional planes, which were fixed to the tail end of the airship, the sort of thinner end of the sausage, which had on them these rudder on the bottom one and the elevators, the flaps on the each plane on the either side of the airship. There was no plane on top that I remember. Yeah, there were just the three stabilizing planes with their flaps, rudder and elevators.
So there were then a great many airships, in a sense, lying around the place like Meccano says, waiting to be put together.
Well, they were in different stages of evolution. When you say a great many, I would have supposed there could be as many as six at a time, that is three or four in each of the big two big hangars. I suppose one was finished every few days or once a week. We had to make our own. And
can you describe this process of putting the ships together in a little detail?
Well, essentially the airship consists of those elements that I've described, that is to say, the envelope, which is made by people like Dunlop's and other people who are dealing with rubberized fabric, the car, which was the fuselage of an aeroplane, a BE aeroplane, and the planes and flaps on them, which were rudder and elevator. Those were the essential components. They were connected together by wires, which were rigging wires to hold the car in the right relationship to the envelope, and control wires, which were the wires which extended from the tail end of the fuselage, the car, to the elevator and rudder on the planes. These airships were about 150 feet long, so you can see that quite a lot of wire was involved in the process. There was one more element that I haven't mentioned. Those were the nose stiffeners, which were to keep the nose from blowing inside out, if you were rather blowing outside in, because the main pressure of your forward flight came onto the nose, and so the nose had to be stiffened. Then, of course, there were the valves, the gas valves on the top, which were fitted into grommets to release gas when you wanted to. And there was a gas valve at the bottom, which was an automatic pressure-releasing gas valve so that you couldn't burst your aeroplane, your envelope by accident. That's to say, the gas valve at the bottom was quite a large thing, which was blown open by pressure or could be opened by hand. Similarly, there were two ballonets inside the balloon which would be inflated with air, not gas, and those were the things which kept the airship in shape. The major part of the envelope, the sausage-shaped thing, was full of hydrogen gas, or not altogether full. It would have been quite flabby, but for what were called the ballonets. That is, one ballonet forward and one ballonet aft, which were inflated with air. And that air was derived by a scoop, which you lowered behind, you fixed behind the propeller, so that when you were going along through the air, there was a pressure all the time on this scoop. And when you opened what were called the crab pots, which was a sort of sleeve valve in the airship, in a tube in the airship inside, that connected the pressure of the ordinary air to either the forward ballonet or to the after ballonet. Ballonet, you could pronounce it if you like to be very French. They acted as trimmers. If you were heavy by the stern, you would put more air into your forward ballonet, which would tend to make you heavier by the nose. And if you were vice versa, you would put more air into the after ballonet. So that was your device for keeping pressure. And then when the pressure went up and you wanted to keep it to a steady pressure of not more than 40 millimeters of water, you would open the air ducts and release air rather than releasing hydrogen. That was the principle on which you kept the balloon in shape. And that was the principle by which you trimmed the balloon for its, or at least trimmed the airship for its steadiness of nose up or nose down when you were flying.
What part did the trainee pilots play in this process of erecting the airships?
Well, the pilot, first of all, had to know how to and to supervise the building of his airship. We built our own ships, and when you had built your ship, then you were allowed to fly it under instruction, and the instruction consisted not of the ordinary formal dual instruction that we've all got accustomed to. The instructor would sit in the captain's seat in this two-seater body or fuselage, and he would fly the airship, and you would experience what he was doing by him shouting at you and telling you what he was doing, and you would sit in the front seat and you wouldn't have any part in the control of the thing at all. And then after you'd done one or two landings or three or four landings with this instructor, he would say, all right, now you do a flight. And he would get out, and he might sit in the front seat and you would sit in the back seat, and you would fly around, do a few circuits, land with your trail rope down, take off again, or fly away again, and so on. And when he thought you were okay, he would say, right, well, you're an airship pilot.